Welcome to Dark History Time with Brian. A few things before we get started. Need to let you know that you might find some of this material disturbing. We do use adult language on the show. Listener discretion is advised. Some events that took place on July 4th weekend in 1999. I vividly remember this case because it happened here in Illinois and a little bit in Indiana over that holiday weekend. So there was the constant news updates about what was going on with it. Some people that are younger may recall the DC sniper shortly after 9/11, how that was always being updated constantly, so it was easy to kind of keep track of where things were at and what was going on. This was the same situation. I don't know why it kind of, after it was all said and done, it just kind of got forgotten about, which is kind of weird because it was pretty crazy at the time. Maybe it's just become the norm now. I hate to say that, but maybe it has. So anyway, getting into the weekend of July 4th, 1999, story takes place over 9 different towns in 2 different states. I've made the conscious decision not to mention this guy's name until the very end, just because I feel like he is that unimportant in the grand scheme of things, and I don't want him to be, he's already martyred in the church, loose quotes, church that he belonged to, so I don't want to give him too much credit. I will say that as a youth, he had it pretty good. He grew up in the North Shore subdivision in Chicago. His dad was a doctor and his mom was a real estate agent, so he was not want for anything. He was provided for. He started going to the University of Illinois in 1996. Within a month, he was reported as being a peeping Tom and touching women inappropriately. On one of these peeping excursions, he was caught by the cops, I assume U of I, decided to give his name as Erwin Rommel, if that sounds familiar to anybody. That was the field marshal for the Nazis in World War II. He was part of he was known as the Desert Fox. He won a lot of accolades in Africa during World War II. But that's our first hint of where this guy's mind is. Throwing off a infamous Nazi as his name. In 1997 at the U of I, he was arrested for having pot and a bong in his dorm room. Minor stuff, but still it was in a dorm. Then in the spring semester of 1998, hate literature started popping up everywhere in dorm cafeterias and laundry rooms. Anti-Semitic flyers were stuffed into the student newspaper and posted on a display case for the Jewish Studies program. And then things started to get even worse. He started hitting his girlfriend. She waited 5 months till she filed a police report, got an order of protection, and then to give you another hint on how big a piece of shit this guy is, later after that incident, he faxed her a little disclaimer that he had written up that he asked her to sign saying that he wasn't abusive at all. He was arrested, and he dropped out of the U of I before he had any of his hearings. He enrolls as a sophomore at Indiana University over in Bloomington, Indiana. In May of 98, hate literature starts getting tucked into the windshield wiper, or under windshield wipers. Flyers and stickers are all over the place. Pamphlets are tossed onto lawns and driveways all around the Indiana University campus. It was pretty easy to figure out where it was coming from. The campus or the university asked him to please keep the literature off of campus. So he went ahead and papered all of downtown Bloomington, Indiana. Because of the confrontation with them asking him not to do that on campus, he even stirred up a little debate that got quite a bit of attention for himself about free speech. Yes, it's hate speech, but isn't he also entitled to it since it's free speech? Yada, yada, yada. I believe there was a demonstration of about 500 people. So, yeah, there was even a free speech demonstration slash debate on campus stirred up by this kid's distribution of all the hate speech and campus telling him, please don't do that. So, things aren't going well in college for him. He decides he's going to withdraw $19,000 from his savings account. Ooh, dropped out.
I wish I had that in my right. savings account.
Dropped out and decided he was going to start following Mr. Matthew Hale and the World Church of the Creator. And it's not necessarily a side tangent, but I'm going to go ahead and educate a little bit about what this church is all about. At the time, it was one of the fastest growing hate groups in the 1990s. It was labeled that by the Anti-Defamation League. They operated out of East Peoria, Illinois, in a living room and a bedroom. It was operated by Matt Hale, who lived in that house with his dad. Hale's dogma preached that whites are an elite race with an aristocratic position in nature's scheme of things. Everyone else is a deadly enemy who belongs to the inferior mud races. The most dangerous of all is the Jewish race. I'm going to stop my reading right now to say that I'm going to read straight from their stuff. I don't hold these views. There is going to be use of the N-word at least one time. I don't believe in that bullshit, but I'm illustrating a point here by reading from their stuff. So the church manual doesn't directly sanction violence, but it does instruct members to hate their enemies, namely Jews, niggers, and the mud races, and to work hard to bring about a white world as soon as possible. A long section describes the security legions, called the White Berets and the White Rangers, whose main goal is to revive the attitude of white militancy, the will to fight for what is white and defend the one and only, true and revolutionary, white racial religion. Hale also stated that the group can take the law into their own hands if the Jewish-occupied governments of the world try to block distribution of their hate literature or their promoting of the full practice of our religion. At different times, Matt Hale had claimed that the church had about 7,000 members and about 40,000 adherents, although watchdog groups thought that there were only a few hundred actual members. Whatever the true figure was, it was clear that the organization had been growing rapidly. There were chapters in at least 17 states, and the group was particularly strong in California and Florida. At the time, their internet sites appeared to outnumber all other white supremacist hate groups combined. When Hale had assumed the leadership of the church in 1996, the group had all but faded away. Its founder had committed suicide 3 years before. The organization had been officially dissolved after it lost a $1 million lawsuit that found the church partially liable for a racist murder by a reverend of their church. Since Hale took command of the group, the level of violence had escalated. A black father and his son leaving a 1997 theater were badly beaten by some of the church's skinheads after they refused to accept hate literature shoved at them. As the group members were awaiting trial, their Southeast Regional Director was found attempting to intimidate a witness. Four church followers robbed and pistol-whipped the owner of a Florida adult video store in 1998, choosing the video store because they believed all media outlets were controlled by Jews. According to prosecutors, they planned to send some of their loot back to Hale and Peoria. The Southern Poverty Law Center and other watchdog groups linked church members to other attacks, including the bombing of an NAACP office in Washington and a planned attack on Portland's synagogues and a black church in Los Angeles. Police found their literature at the home of Matthew and Tyler Williams, brothers who are suspects, or were suspects, in the slaying of a gay couple and the torching of a Sacramento synagogue. To understand their success story requires a grasp of what it is not. Unlike Christian identity hate groups, there's no expectation that followers believe in Jesus or memorize scripture. In fact, the manual calls itself a far superior religion to Christianity. Unlike more established segregationist groups such as the Klan or the National Association for the Advancement of White People, there's no old guard to boss around newcomers, nor does it have the whiff of failure and decay that surrounds hate groups with longer histories. It's interesting to note that the word Aryan, used famously by the Nazis and almost all other white power groups, does not appear even once in this church manual. Hale cleverly turned the tables on minorities by claiming that whites were the persecuted group, that hate speech is their religious and civil right. writing to Indiana University newspaper in support of the guy we're talking about. Hale made his case saying, why is it that there are those who are there who would like to violate our freedoms under the Constitution by preventing our peaceful dissemination of our religious views? Shame on you, you hypocrites. You claim to believe in civil rights, and yet yell no free speech for racists. The longest section in their manual urges members to distribute leaflets and pamphlets everywhere, wanted or not. Call up radio talk shows, post signs on telephone poles, disrupt minority group meetings by disputing the Holocaust or Black History events. Some of Hale's helpful hints skirt threats of extortion. Call up businesses and ask them for the support of the white race and the World Church of the Creator. Now, if these people are rude or hostile, tell them the church will be calling for an economic boycott of their business, and the church may very well picket in front of their businesses. He also maneuvered the church into the mainstream of the skinhead subculture when one of their official websites was taken down after the events that we're going to get into here in a little bit. Visitors were redirected to the homepages for Resistance Records, long the center for skinhead white power rock. One popular band was even named Rojava, after the battle cry for racial holy war. When Matt Hale claimed the church's title of Pontificus Maximus in 1996, the title being Latin for supreme leader of the church, he was a 27-year-old who already had some media attention for his college group, the American White Supremacist Party. Although he concedes that there were only 8 members in the group, his sanctioned biography boasts that he was interviewed by nationwide media and portions of his speeches were broadcast on CNN. In the days after the events that I'm going to describe a little bit later, Hale demonstrated his media skills, juggling interviews with dozens of broadcast and print journalists. He described the guy I'm talking about as a martyr for free speech, and told Reuters that his violence was because he felt oppressed by those who sought to protest his hate speech. He said this gentleman was a person who was persecuted for his views just as I have been. He told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, people have their own free will. They do what they please. And he told the Orange County Register, I've always encouraged our members to be legal. I've certainly never encouraged violence. But exactly how well did Mr. Hale know the subject of my talk today? He waffled when he told organizations that he was a newer member who he didn't really know. Later, he did admit that he knew him pretty well. He was certain that he was no longer a member, but he couldn't be sure if he'd resigned in April or May. However, in their June newsletter, it was noted that Smith, I'm going to go ahead and say his last name, that Smith has relocated to Central Illinois to assist PM Hale at World Headquarters. Only later did Hale announce that he had found a strange resignation letter that absolved Hale in the church of responsibility. But he had clearly followed Smith's doings for some time. Besides writing the December letter to the Indiana student newspaper, Hale said or named Smith creator of the year for the controversy that he created in Bloomington over the free speech ideas and for distributing over 5,000 copies of the church's pamphlet in a single month. He encouraged others to view Brother Smith's activism as an example to follow. The two men were also closely involved with Hale's efforts to become a lawyer. Hale had passed his law school exams, but the Illinois State Bar Association called an unusual ethics hearing because of his racist views. On April 11th, Smith testified before the bar that Mr. Pontifex Maximus had the ethics worthy of a lawyer. On July 2nd, the same day that the events that we're going to get into started, the State Bar Association denied Hale a license to practice law for the grounds of gross deficiency in moral character. Hale told reporters that the decision likely triggered the events. Our church has always promoted nonviolent legal means. What I really suspect is that maybe the denial of my law license is what angered him so much that he may have acted in this way. So, background on this racist church that this gentleman had fallen heavily into leads us to the events that started that weekend.
It's a very sizable church, and that's really close to home.
Really close to home. Yep. And I remember when Matt Hale was all in the news for before this, because like I said, I mean, he had made news before for his bullshit, and then after this, of course, he was all over the news again because how much of the blame lays with him and the church. So on Friday, July 2nd, 1999, in the West Rogers Park neighborhood of Chicago, which happens to be, at the time, the largest concentration of Orthodox Jews in the city, in six separate incidents, a gunman in a light blue Ford Taurus shot six Orthodox Jewish men as they walked through the neighborhood. Same gunman then drove to Skokie, where he fired seven shots at Ricky Birdsong. This one hit home for me at the time because Ricky Birdsong was a former head basketball coach at Northwestern University. I remember him. I was watching basketball all the time. He was walking near his house with two of his children. He was only 43 years old, and he ended up dying in the hospital that night. Still the same night, in the suburb of Northbrook, he shot at an Asian couple who happened to be in a passing vehicle. Fortunately, no injuries were sustained in that shooting. Saturday morning, July 3rd, in Springfield, he shot and injured a black man, and in the afternoon in Decatur, he wounded a black minister who was walking. Later that night, he shot at a group of six Asian students. He ended up wounding one. He shot him in the leg. It never gave the exact location, but it was on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana. So there's another tie here to us. Finally, on July 4th, Sunday, he drove over to Bloomington, Indiana, the last place that he had attended college, and he fired at a group that was leaving a Korean church, killing 26-year-old Won Jun Yoon. Finally, on Sunday, the 4th of July, at about 10:40, it all came to an end. At about 9:30 that night, officers noticed a van that had been reported stolen earlier in Ina, Illinois, from a gas station. This kid approached a woman and her child at the gas station demanding the van. They initially had refused, but then he pulled out a gun, so they gave him the van. Police pursued the van for about 5 miles on Highway 37, entering Salem, Illinois. As it entered Salem, the vehicle swerved sharply off the road and slammed into a metal pipe. This was because the driver had decided to shoot himself rather than being caught by the cops. Of course, if you haven't figured out by now that this guy is an inept little turd, he shot himself in the chin. All he did is basically blow his chin off. Caused him to wreck the vehicle, but it didn't finish the job. Officers approached both sides of the van, wrestled with him briefly. They heard two muffled shots. Neither one of them had their weapons drawn. Neither one of them realized or thought they were hit. They weren't. He had shot himself in the chest. Still, I don't know that it was ever determined, past it being a self-inflicted gunshot by the weapon that he owned, if it was because of the wrestling or if he did it
as a last resort.
Yeah, as a last resort.
I mean, he was already trying to go that route to begin
exactly.
with.
Exactly. Exactly.
It'd be negotiable if he tried to end it
right
at any moment's notice.
In the van, they recovered a .22 caliber semi-automatic pistol and a .380 semi-automatic pistol, both of which were used in all of the shootings. And all of his wounds were self-inflicted by the .22 pistol. The Ford Taurus that he had used all up until the end there was found in Ina. It had been abandoned. The FBI was called. They went through it. They found a flak jacket, empty pack of cigarettes, empty pop bottles, a single $5 bill, and a single $1 bill. Kind of weird. And I tell you all of this to tell you that these crimes were committed by one Benjamin Nathaniel Smith, 21 whole years of age at the time of his death.
He's a piece of work.
He's a piece of work. He's easy enough to find a mugshot. Very typical looking white shooter that unfortunately over the past 2 or 3 years, or 5 maybe, we have come to expect the look of. He's got the look. He just does. It also goes to show in 99, we had racially motivated white shooters just like we do now. It's nothing new. Ties tenuously in with last week's episode on the Tulsa race massacres. There's a lot of things that have these undertones. But Yeah, for some reason, and it doesn't seem to matter where they come from. I mean, he came from a good upbringing. His parents, years later, finally went on the record and said, hey, we have no idea where that came from. We didn't teach hate of anything, and he was fine as a kid. Somewhere, once he went to college, one of the sources I had read was talking about they noticed a difference between semesters. I mean, he got in some trouble at the start, and then Peeping Tom and touching somebody, he probably wasn't going to turn out to be a good guy anyway.
Yeah, those are usually pretty warning signs. Right. So he's starting out with little crimes, and they're kind of
But then to flip the switch and just make it all race, one of the things I read, he had a black roommate that they said he got along with great, but then he came back from a semester break, and it was all a different story. So you never know what it is that gets to these people. Clearly something got to him, spoke to him on some level, and as insignificant as he is, he decided to try to gain some notoriety and significance by perpetrating acts of violence, as most of these people do. They're nothing. They've never amounted to anything, so their acts have to be something, and it is truly their acts. It's not them that amounts to anything. And
no, they want to do things that are attention-grabbing. They want their mugshots in the paper.
Yeah, this kid
becomes a publicity stunt at a certain point.
He clearly was looking for the notoriety to go along with it. But he was also weak enough to know that he couldn't stand what the consequences were going to be for it. So he takes his own life, and I think that says about all we need to know about Mr. Ben Smith.
I agree.
And on that note, that's what are we on? Episode 4 now, I think?
It's
4 or 5?
Episode 4. The 5th upload, but the 4th actual episode.
So I was telling Austin earlier that for better or worse, some of these things just pop into mind. I was trying to think of what I wanted to hit on and started doing a little research, and then just out of nowhere, Ben Smith and Matthew Hale popped into my head. I was like, hey, you know what? I bet not too many people know about these guys. So,
yeah, I had no clue about them. Yeah. That's so, very close to home.
Right. I mean, he went to the U of I, and then he shot at some kids at the U of I. So that's about as close as we get, I think. So I wanted to throw that out there. I've noticed that I am becoming a bit of a unknown case podcast to begin with, but I like that idea. I hope you guys like it as well. Please give me some feedback. We've got almost 50 listens out of our fourth episodes.
And
slowly
on Apple,
getting there. We're on Apple, Spotify, a number of others that I don't really recognize, but those are the two big ones that I know everybody follows on. So please keep listening. Tell me what you think. I mean, we talk on Morbidly Macabre about constructive criticism. Give it to me. I want to know, do you like what I'm doing? Do you want me to do more? Well-known cases, I know I will get to them, but I feel like they've been hit so many times, I don't want to start with that. I'll just sound like another retread, and I don't necessarily want to do that to begin with. We are in the process of working out how to get some interviews on here. I know I have some author friends that like to talk about their books in those cases. So we'll be doing that. Dark History and Horror Conventions coming up October 23rd. We're rolling along with that pretty well. I think I'm down to about 12 or 13 spots left for that, and that's it. It'll be full. I haven't announced a whole lot recently, but I am probably more true crime-centric this year than I have been in the past, which makes me very happy. I will say that I have a publishing company, Genius Publishers, coming from California and bringing 3 of their authors. They're coming from California on their dime, bringing 3 of their authors to our show.
That's exciting.
Yeah. A vendor I announced yesterday, Cryptid Comforts, they're coming from Washington State. So we have people coming from all over the country. We have, like I said, there's going to be more true crime stuff there than maybe at any time in the past. I am not directly taking on Crime Con, but I know I got a little bit of attention from my friends and fans in the true crime community when I mentioned that my tickets are maybe a tenth of the price of what CrimeCon tickets are. And they're like, oh, shit, are you taking on CrimeCon? And one more reason to love you and come. That's actually from the publisher out of California. He's like, one more reason to want to come. I want to do what those guys claim to do. I want to present people that know their stuff, that aren't paid TV talking heads, that have actually lived through these things, and I want to do it at a price that John Q can afford. I think the cheapest Crime Con ticket I saw was $159. Whew. Most expensive mine's ever been is $20. So you do the math, and you can come see people like another one of my authors that's coming, tentatively, hopefully. She's been there in the past, and she has dealt with Crime Con. They only pay their celebrity true crime talking heads, the people from the ID channel and Oxygen and all that good shit.
So everybody else has to make Everybody else has to make commission.
Yep. And usually have to get themselves there. There again, that's the case with my with me. I usually can't provide them their passage here, but they know that, and they also know that I'm not a billion-dollar company like ID and all these other places that put on Crime Con. So yeah, there's my blurb. I saved it for the end. That way you guys can, if you don't care to listen to me rant and rave and talk about my show, you could shut me off before we get here. Yeah, that's about it. Spotify, Apple Podcast, AnchorFM.com.
Anchor.fm.
Thank you.
It's weird. I know. It's
Anchor.fm. Follow me there. Follow me on Facebook. I'd love to see more followers and fan interaction on Facebook. Same name, Dark History and Time with Brian. Twitter, Instagram. Twitter is seeming to be very dead lately for everything. TikTok. The lovely and talented Miss Tiana hooked me up with the idea of doing TikTok. Sage gives me a hard time because she had mentioned it before. She's like, yeah, it took somebody else to get you to actually do it. And I was like, oh. Yeah. I'm not as active on there as I probably could be, but I am trying to show you guys some things that I think this past week I did a couple videos with some things that I picked up at different places. A stone that was by Clyde Barrow's grave, some things from the Barrow gas station. Can't remember what else I've shown off, but I've got more. Can show you those. Did a video from one of the bridges where a dead body was found here in Illinois. I think I threw up the James Dean picture yesterday, James Dean's gravestone. So we'll start throwing that up. That just gives you a better idea of who I am, what I'm about. And, yeah, come to Dark History and Horror Con October 23rd and meet me, and we'll talk all about it. Thanks for listening, guys. Continue to do so. Please tell all your friends, fans of true crime, and anybody else you think might be interested. I'd love to have you on board. Good night.